From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, former U.S. Senator and presidential candidate George McGovern discusses the life and death of his daughter, Terry. She froze to death in December of 1994 at the age of 45 after collapsing in the snow in an alcoholic stupor. She was an alcoholic for many years and had been in and out of treatment. McGovern struggled over how to best help her. He has a new book about his daughter. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Dilate, the new release by singer Ani DeFranco. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics. For 50 years, the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George McGovern is tormented by questions about his daughter's death. Terry McGovern was a longtime alcoholic who had been in and out of detox and treatment centers. In December of 1994, she blacked out in the snow and froze to death. She was 45 years old. George McGovern wonders why his daughter died like some deserted outcast when she had a loving family. He wonders if he and other members of the family made mistakes in the way they handled her illness. McGovern is a former U.S. senator from South Dakota. In 1972, he was the Democratic presidential candidate for president. He lost to Nixon in a landslide. Now he heads the Middle East Council in Washington, D.C. He's written a new book called Terry, My Daughter's Life and Death Struggle with Alcoholism. I asked George McGovern to explain what happened the day she died.
Well, she was released from the detoxification center in Madison, Wisconsin on December 12th. It was about 9 o'clock in the morning. She left against the wishes of the people at the center. They had no authority to hold her, and she wanted to go. So she went to meet with a friend of hers who she spent a pleasant 2 hours visiting with, and they renewed her driver's license during that time. I have a picture in the book of Terry smiling broadly on that license, which of course was the last photo taken of her before she died. She then spent the afternoon with her landlord in a new apartment that she wanted to move into that was near where her two little daughters lived. But about 5 o'clock, she decided to leave the apartment, supposedly to get some supplies for her new home. She walked over to Williamson Street in Madison, Wisconsin, a familiar neighborhood for her, stopped at the Crystal Corner Bar. She ran into a Vietnam veteran who offered her a vodka on the rocks, and that was the beginning of some 2.5 hours of drinking. She stumbled out of that bar about 8:30 when they refused to serve her any longer. It was a bitterly cold night, some 7 inches of snow on the ground. She walked about 50 feet, found herself in a little alleyway, eventually behind a small print shop. She fell in the snow somewhere between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, we believe. They didn't find her body until noontime. The next day, she had frozen to death in the snow.
She had expected to be sent, I think the following day or in a couple of days, to a treatment center for her alcoholism, and she really didn't want to go. Do you think that she almost knew she was drinking herself to death to kind of avoid further treatment, to avoid having to face her own alcoholism?
I think she knew she was desperately ill. Her journal has comments about how sick she had become and how discouraged she had become. And yet, that last day, there's no question in my mind, she expected to resume her life. She really thought she was going to pull it off this time. She had a new apartment. She had this new driver's license. She was ready for another effort. I had talked with her just a couple of days before that, and we talked about her coming home with her two little daughters at Christmas time. I don't think there was any complete resignation on her part. I think she was discouraged, but at the same time determined to give it one more effort. Unfortunately, they stop at the Crystal Bar, and that first drink set her off, and from that point on, it almost seemed like her death was foreordained.
Your daughter had been in and out of treatment centers for years, and every time it looked like she was making progress, she'd have a relapse. In the last few months of her life, under the advice of professionals, you and your wife had distanced yourself from her, a decision that you came to regret after her death. What was the thinking behind that advice?
Well, the counselor who told us to do that is an old friend of ours and a very good man. I don't criticize him for his judgment. It was his view that Eleanor and I had become so obsessed with Terry's illness that it was interfering with our own health and our own peace of mind. He also questioned whether it was the right course for Terry. His view was that if she was ever going to get well, she had to confront the desperate character of her illness, and he thought possibly that Eleanor and I were carrying too much of the burden and perhaps even enabling her to continue a very dangerous lifestyle. But acting under his advice, we did quit calling so much. We eased off on the letter writing. There were no visits during that period. I regret that now. I think any parent would. Obviously, the doctor who gave us that advice didn't know that Terry was going to die during that distancing period. Certainly, we didn't know that. If I could just pass on a word of advice to other people who have this dilemma about what to do with an alcoholic in the family, I think if you're going to follow that course of putting some distance between you and the alcoholic, you should accompany that by frequent calls, at least once a week, just to see how they're doing, to tell them you love them, that you're still with them, that anything you do, you're doing because you think it might be helpful to them. Alcoholics need that kind of love and support and reassurance.
Did you not make weekly phone calls like that?
We did not. There were several weeks during the summer, at one point 6 weeks, when we were in Innsbruck, Austria, where I was a guest professor for the summer, where we were not in touch with her. I will say this, during the last 2 weeks of her life, her mother had 4 different telephone calls with her that ran anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes. So that was close communication. I had a couple of visits with her, too, in the last couple of weeks of her life. I just wish I had gone out of my way to tell her that I loved her, that I hated the disease that had afflicted her, but that there wasn't the slightest doubt about my love for her.
What was it that you were able to do that made you feel most useful?
Well, I think listening to her problems, from time to time, I would just encourage her to talk. Obviously, the times I was successful in persuading her to go into treatment give me some satisfaction. I think we helped keep Terry alive for 45 years because we were always open to the possibility of treatment, encouraging her to stay in the AA program, the Alcoholics Anonymous program, letting her come home when things got too desperate. I think all of those things helped her to stay alive.
One of the things that you did to try to help her is, for instance, when she got an apartment, you told the landlord that if she couldn't pay the rent, you'd back her up and pay it yourself. I'm wondering if things like that were ever embarrassing to you, to have Senator George McGovern being on the phone to the landlord saying, okay, if she's too drunk to pay the rent, I'll back it up.
It wasn't so much embarrassing to me as it was a case of being ambivalent about what was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Was I, as my daughters would sometimes tell me, enabling her to keep drinking by almost underwriting a middle-class lifestyle, even though she wasn't taking responsibility for her own life? That's a danger you have to be careful about. The people who, with experience in the Alcoholics Anonymous program, warn you against what they call enabling people to keep drinking. But that's a difficult line to draw. We eventually, I think, got to the point where we made clear to Terry that we weren't going to help finance her drinking, but we did not want her out on the street either. So I'm tormented by that decision. I have to tell you, though, that having lost Terry, I don't regret one act of kindness, one act of compassion, one gesture of generosity towards her. What I regret is that I couldn't have done more to convince her that she had the love and support of her family.
George McGovern is my guest, former U.S. Senator from South Dakota, former Democratic Party candidate for president. He's now the head of the Middle East Policy Council in Washington, D.C. He's written a memoir called Terry about his daughter who died at the age of 45 of alcoholism. We'll take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with George McGovern, he's written a new memoir called Terry about his daughter who died at the age of 45 of alcoholism. In your memoir about your daughter called Terry, you've published excerpts of her journals. And I'm wondering how you feel about having read them, if you felt at all like you were violating her privacy by reading them.
I struggled with that almost every day I was working on this book. I have to tell you that Eleanor, my wife, did not want me to write this book. She felt that it was an invasion of Terry's privacy, of her letters, of her journals, of her diaries. But now that she's seen the manuscript, she's glad that I wrote the book, and I am too. I have the feeling that if we had some way to communicate with Terry, she'd be pleased with this book. I'm an old history teacher. Terry had a sense of history. I'm convinced that at some level, when Terry wrote these frank confessions about what was going on in her life, she wanted them shared with other people. And I think this book can be helpful to other people.
There's a journal excerpt I'd like for you to read. It's on page 20, and it's something that she wrote in 1993.
Okay. She said, I arrived in Norfolk for Dad's Army Air Corps reunion. Our drive down from Washington was easy and enjoyable. He is much easier to be with than when he was in national politics. I was going to say he had no business being so self-centered and obsessed when he had dependent children. Then I thought, I've done the same thing with alcoholism. There is no difference. I will tell him sometime.
Did she ever tell you that?
She came pretty close to that. As you know from reading the book, I print some of the things that are critical about myself that Terry said. I think she had ambivalent feelings about my political career. She was very proud of the causes I championed in American politics, especially my efforts to end American involvement in the Vietnam War. But at the same time, she and I had a very special, close relationship, and she resented the intrusion of public affairs and the business of the Senate on my time with her.
Your daughter wrote in one of her entries, it seems I remember too well, whenever I was happy, joyful, visible, I got smashed down. Does that read true to you?
It really doesn't. I think that what happens with alcoholics, and this is verified by the long years of experience of the professionals in dealing with alcoholics, is that they engage in what is called externalizing. By that I mean the tendency to blame their problems on their parents, on their siblings, on their peers, on their teachers. Usually it's the people they love most that they direct their resentment toward. But Terry, in her later years, talks repeatedly about her love for her parents, for her brother, for her sisters, and I think that was the real Terry speaking. I think sometimes these outbursts against her sisters and against her mother and me came when life was just so painful for her because of what she referred to as her alcohol-induced depression, that she just had to find somebody other than herself to blame.
There's another excerpt of your daughter's journal I'd like you to read for us. This is on page 129. And this is the part that begins tonight, was the first wounded child group.
Tonight was the first wounded child group. I didn't like it very much and have some anxiety about sharing too soon who Dad is. I feel ashamed that I was wanting so much to ensure that I would be noticed and taken seriously.
Oh, that must have been interesting for you to read her ambivalence about your fame, your notoriety.
Well, there's several poignant references in this book that are similar to that, where she says to people, I want you to know who my dad is. He's George McGovern, and he ran for president. She goes on about these things, and she says it is because she wanted to feel good about her own stature. She, in one place, says that she didn't want people to think she was a complete loser, so she told him who her father was. I find that very touching, but it's also kind of sad because Terry was a person who, in her own right, had every reason for self-respect. She was a person of high intelligence, a person of great compassion, with just a marvelous sense of humor. And yet this problem of declining self-esteem plagued her from the time she was a teenager.
And her failure to, you know, achieve anything and her failure to, totally give up alcohol must have seemed like an even greater failure measured up against your success.
I think that's right. I think that Terry knew that she had great opportunities in our family. She participated heavily in the 1972 presidential campaign. She was speaking on platforms all over this country, sometimes to audiences of thousands of people, and she did extremely well. So that told her that she had the talent and ability to do these things. And yet, with the passage of time, alcohol robbed her of the capacity to perform in that fashion, to hold a job, and to do other things that would have enhanced her self-confidence and her self-esteem.
In another journal entry, Terry wrote, "My mother often tried to help me when I went to her, but mostly I remember her wanting to change me, not being able to meet me where I was." You know, when I read that, I thought, what an impossible situation it is for parents to be in a situation like this, because if you don't try to change her when she's suffering from alcoholism, then you feel really bad that you're not doing your best to help her get well. And, of course, if you do try to change her, then she could have the reaction she has here, that it's just hard to go to you for help because all you do is be critical and try to change her. There's no easy answer of how to behave.
Well, it was very painful for me to include that passage in the book. It's harder for me to include criticism of Eleanor than it is criticism of myself, because I think Eleanor was almost blameless as a mother. She was so dedicated to those five children of ours. It's one of the reasons that Eleanor decided not to work outside the home. She felt that with five children coming within a period of 10 years, she had a full-time obligation at home. And that was the attitude of most women in that post-World War II period. So she gave everything she had to Terry and to the other children. And I think that Terry knew that. Eleanor was her best friend, her most dependable advisor, the person who would always listen to her patiently in the middle of the night or any other time.
What was your wife's reaction when she read that journal excerpt?
Well, she was hurt by it. She had read the journals herself, as well as reading these passages in my book, and it does hurt her because Eleanor has lived for these children. She hasn't had the other sources of emotion and ego support that I've had as a public figure. So for a mother to read criticism of that kind from one of her children is very painful.
Looking back now, do you think that you were too judgmental or not judgmental or enough? Is there anything that you would want to change in that?
Yes, there is. I wish I had always remembered that Terry was sick, that once she became seriously addicted, she had an illness that had to be treated as such. I wish that I had been more careful about separating my resentment of that disease from my love for her. My dad was an old-fashioned Methodist minister, and I remember him saying to the congregation several times, "Hate the sin, but love the sinner." I wish I had applied that doctrine to modify it to say, hate the alcoholism, but love the alcoholic, and make that clear to her.
Did you often feel like there were two different Terrys, the sober Terry and the drunk Terry?
I did feel that way, and one time I said to her shortly before she died, she was in a period of sobriety, and we were in Madison, Wisconsin, and having dinner, I was just struck that night by what a endearing person she was, so perceptive and sensitive and compassionate, and as usual, so funny and humorous. I said to her near the end of the evening, "You know, Terry, I don't think there's a more lovable creature on this earth than you when you're sober." And she said, "Well, thank you, Dad." But then just with a touch of sadness, she said, "Maybe I'm a little bit lovable even when I'm not sober, even when I'm drinking." And I think that's true. We have to sustain that love for alcoholics, even when their behavior is not very attractive.
George McGovern's new book is called Terry, My Daughter's Life and Death Struggle with Alcoholism. He'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics. For 50 years, the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what it's like having family problems when you're running for office and in the public eye. We continue our conversation with George McGovern. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Dilate, the new release by singer Ani DeFranco. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with George McGovern. He's a former U.S. senator from South Dakota. In 1972, he was the Democratic candidate for president. His new memoir, Terry, is about his daughter's struggles with alcoholism. She froze to death after collapsing in the snow in December of 1994. She was 45. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the impact of Terry on your political life. In 1968, when you were running for re-election to the Senate, you picked up the newspaper one day and read this headline, "Senator's Daughter Arrested on Drug Charge." The senator turned out to be you. What happened?
Well, I was in California speaking at a memorial service for Robert Kennedy about a month after he died. I had a press conference scheduled that morning, and in preparation for that, I walked out on the porch of the home where I was staying and picked up the Los Angeles Times, and there it was, Senator's daughter arrested on drug charge, and of course it was Terry in Rapid City, South Dakota. It was a serious matter for various reasons, the most important being that the South Dakota legislature had just passed a law making it a mandatory 5-year penitentiary sentence the first time you were picked up on marijuana possession. And here was this 18-year-old daughter of mine who was working in my Senate race in 1968, picked up on a marijuana possession charge. Fortunately, there was an error in the search warrant, and the court threw out the case. But this was a very dreadful experience for Terry, and it was certainly a hair-raising experience for me. I thought it might end my political career right there.
Did any of your political opponents try to use it to end your political career?
Well, the initial arrest was probably set up from all the evidence we have by partisan opponents of mine who picked up a report that Terry was with 30 other young people in this motel, and they got a search warrant served by the local justice of the peace. I have no doubt that was done for political purposes to embarrass me. None of the other youngsters were bothered. None of their rooms were investigated. But the people of South Dakota reacted very well to that. I had Republicans as well as Democrats stopping me on the street for weeks after that, saying that was a setup. I don't like the way your daughter was treated in that case. And it turned out to be the easiest reelection campaign I ever had.
Your daughter was, though, actually smoking marijuana at the time. How did you feel about that? I would imagine a lot of the young people who were working in your campaign were smoking marijuana.
Well, this was the 1960s, and I can't pretend that it wasn't widespread, not only in the young people working in that campaign, but in college students across the country, even high school students. Indeed, in Rapid City, South Dakota, the place where this happened, the superintendent of schools told me that he estimated at least a fourth of the high school students in that city were then experimenting with marijuana. I don't know how heavy that use was with Terry or other young people at that time, but certainly this was what was going on at the time.
So were you upset by it?
I was upset by it. I thought, first of all, it was a danger to her health and well-being. I thought she came very close to putting herself in jail because of the nature of that South Dakota law. And beyond that, I thought it was a very reckless thing to do politically at a time I was engaged in a very tough race for re-election to the Senate that later developed into a bid for the presidency.
I wonder if you could read how it affected your daughter. Was she embarrassed by it, defiant that she was set up like this?
She was terribly embarrassed by it and terribly sad about it. I would have to say that it was a real trauma in Terry's life. I think she also felt there was a certain amount of unfairness involved in it, that she wasn't any different from the other young people who were out there canvassing votes for me in Rapid City, but it was her room that was targeted. That bothered her.
When you were running for president in 1972, your vice presidential running mate, Thomas Eagleton, was revealed to have had clinical depression, and it turned out he'd been hospitalized and treated with electroshock therapy. And you had to decide whether to keep him on the ticket or whether to, you know, bump him and find somebody who didn't have that kind of problem. Did your daughter's history of depression, because she was depressive as well as alcoholic, did that affect your decision?
It really did. It was the only experience, frankly, that I had had with depression. Terry was the only person I knew who was suffering from depression. So when I discovered that my running mate had the same illness, perhaps in a more advanced and acute form, in that he had gone through rather extensive electric shock therapy, my first reaction was one of compassion. I, of course, was distressed and disturbed that I hadn't been told about this at the time I selected my running mate. But nonetheless, Eleanor and I both decided that the thing to do was to try to stay with Senator Eagleton, and we made that decision. A week later, after we had had a chance to look at it more carefully and to talk to psychiatrists and to talk to other advisors, we decided we had no recourse except to ask Senator Eagleton to step down.
And what are your thoughts about this today? Is there anything you would have done differently there?
You know, it's such a complicated matter to this day. I don't know what the proper course was. I can tell you that I phoned Dr. Carl Menninger, then the best-known psychiatrist in the country, and he said, "Senator, you've got a terrible dilemma on your hands. I would have to tell you, as one who has lectured on mental illness in this country for many, many years, that about half the American public are scared to death of mental illness of any kind, and they're not going to support a national ticket with a person that is as afflicted as your running mate is. On the other hand, almost every family has had some experience with a member of that family who's had to have psychiatric care, and if you now ask Senator Eagleton to step down, they're going to turn against you." So I said, "Well, Dr. Menninger, I guess you're telling me I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't." And he said somewhat sadly, "That's the way I see it." And I think that was the dilemma I was in.
Your daughter had two children with a man who she very much loved. They lived together for several years, but they never actually married. Did you ever say to her, "This is going to make me look really bad politically. You have to get married, or it will be hard for me to get reelected"?
No, I never said that. I must tell you,
you might have been out of politics by then.
No, I was in politics.
You're still in politics.
I was in politics, but I was not actively seeking office at that time. But mm-hmm. I was still very much on the public scene. But I would not have taken that position. This is a very private matter, and I didn't think it was up to me to tell Terry what to do. I can say without any hesitance, I genuinely wish they had been married. I'm pretty old-fashioned about these things, and I think people who fall in love and want to have children need to be married. But I respected her judgment on that and the judgment of her friend. I wish it had worked out better than it did. These two little girls are marvelous. I must say that despite her drinking, Terry gave an awful lot to those daughters of hers, and they're doing just fine.
Who's bringing them up?
They're being brought up by their father. He's a good man. They live in Florida now, but when I was there a couple of weeks ago, I discovered that each one of them is the head of her class, and they're doing well in terms of their personality development and their interests. They're very popular. They're excellent students. I think they'll be okay.
I have another question about how Terry's life affected your political career. When she was 15, she got pregnant and had an abortion. Did anybody ever try to use that against you politically?
They never did. I think that other parents and other adults know that that's a very painful trauma that can happen to people. I think the main person who suffered from that was Terry. It was very difficult for her. And in a sense, that was one more cause of loss of self-esteem and loss of self-confidence on her part.
If you're just joining us, my guest is George McGovern, former senator from South Dakota, former presidential candidate. He now heads the Middle East Policy Council in Washington, D.C. He's written a new memoir about his late daughter, Terry. She died at the age of 45 of alcoholism. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with George McGovern, he's written a memoir about his late daughter, Terry, who died of alcoholism at the age of 45. When you were in politics, did you feel like you had to pretend you had a perfect family? That seems to be a game that most politicians feel that they have to play.
Well, I suppose I was guilty of that. I always did think I had a great family. I still do. I think that one of the things I did with my family that I would do less of if I had it to do over again is, in a sense, kind of using them politically, asking them to get up on the back end of an open car with me or a truck or whatever was available and ride in parades. I think that I would be more cautious about that now. They went along with all of it, but I would spend more time also talking to my family about decisions like that and getting their input rather than just assuming that I could always ask them to bend their will to mine when it came to politics.
I want to get back to a question we were talking about before, which is, you know, when there is an alcoholic in your family, how do you know if what you're doing is functioning as an enabler, or if your criticism is sending them further into alcoholism? And there's a specific incident I'd like you to talk about. There was one day when your daughter said that she desperately needed a drink, and you tried to prevent her from going out to get one. And she went to the car. You dragged her out of the car. The car ended up like moving on its own and kind of crashing into the house next door. And then she wrote in her journal, "Dad, why don't you just?" Actually, was this in the journal that she said?
No, she said that to me.
She said this to you. Tell me what she said.
She said, "Dad, I just have to have another drink. Every cell in my body is just screaming out in agony for it. You have no idea the misery that I feel," and I could see it on her face—just genuine anguish. She said, "Please. Please, please, let me have a drink. Why don't you sit down here with me and have a drink?" This is about 1 o'clock in the morning. There was no alcohol in the house. The bars were closed. We were living on a hill in Washington that was absolutely covered with ice. This is the middle of the winter, and that steep hill was just covered with about an inch of ice. If she had started down that hill in the car, she never would have made it. There was a big ravine at the bottom of the hill. So after turning her down on these pleas for another glass of vodka, I heard a noise out in front of the house a few minutes later, and sure enough, it was Terry out in a car in front of the house getting ready to take off. I raced out of the house, pulled the door open, and begged her to get out of the car. When she refused to do that, I literally struggled with her physically for 5 or 6 minutes trying to pull her out of that car. I'm a very strong person, I think. She was a small, somewhat delicate person. I eventually was able to break her grip on the steering wheel. What I didn't know is that she had moved the car out of the parking gear and had the motor running. It was a new car, and I didn't hear the motor running, so it lurched down the hill and crashed into the house next door. But the point of that story is that it demonstrates how desperate that addiction to alcohol can become.
But I also think it shows how topsy-turvy all of a family member's behavior is and how topsy-turvily it could be interpreted. I mean, in some ways, gosh, maybe you would have been better off just having a drink with her. She wouldn't have gone out of the house. She wouldn't have risked her life. The car wouldn't have crashed. I mean, I'm not really saying, oh, don't you regret that you didn't have a drink with her? But, I mean, there's just, there was no good path of behavior here.
I suppose if I had that circumstance confronting me again exactly as it was, I would have tried to get her another drink and urge her to quiet down and go to sleep. I certainly would have been troubled by it. You hate to give alcohol to somebody who's dying from alcoholism, and that was the course that Terry was flirting with at that time. But under the circumstances, one doesn't know what to do. I've had people that know about this story advise me both ways on what would have been the proper course.
Well, there is a bit of history of depression and alcoholism in your family.
The McGoverns have had a long history of alcoholism. My grandfather McGovern was an alcoholic, my only brother. My brother's son died from alcoholism. My own son has suffered from it, is now in recovery. So there is a history of this, and I've seen it in other families where numerous members of the same clan come down with alcoholism. Now, that doesn't mean if you're born into such a family that you're automatically condemned to alcoholism or to any other addiction. What it does mean is that the risk factors are greater than they are with other families. And I think that has been true in our case.
Your son is a recovering alcoholic. Was he helpful in dealing with Terry, or did he have to really distance himself from her so that he didn't relapse?
Well, actually, Terry's death contributed to Steve going into treatment and then into recovery. I think that he may be one more person that Terry saved. Throughout her life, and also since her life, through her death, numerous people have been helped by her example. She persuaded a lot of other people to go into treatment who successfully recovered, but somehow she couldn't save herself, even though I have a file full of letters from people who tell me that she saved them.
So while Terry was sick, your son was drinking too?
That's correct.
Did you have the same kinds of dilemmas that you faced with him?
Well, he never was as serious a case as Terry. I never once saw him go into a blackout or pass out. He was a kind of a quiet, happy alcoholic most of the time and had a different experience with it than Terry did.
I wonder what it's like for you now to be talking about your daughter and her problems and its emotional impact on you, and to have written this book. I think for most politicians, they spend so much of their lives having to not reveal things about the personal life and not reveal things about the family, because it could be held against them.
Well, I had to write this book. I had to do it just to come to terms with my own anguish over Terry's death. I could not accept the fact that her story was going to end in a snowbank in Madison, Wisconsin at Christmas time, 94. I had to tell the story of this remarkable young woman, and she was remarkable, a person who filled her life with compassionate acts and kindnesses to other people, a very remarkable young woman, but who also, through her own mistakes and her own addiction, has something tragic that we need to understand, too. I wanted that whole story to be told as honestly as I could tell it, to base it in every way I could on her own journals and her own history, and to share that with other people.
I have one last question. If you were in politics today, do you think more would have been made of your daughter's bouts with alcoholism, the fact that she had had an abortion when she was 15, that she had two children with a man she lived with but wasn't married to? Now that family values is such a big issue in campaigns and everybody's always competing with who has the more perfect family, and the public wants to know more and more about the private lives of politicians.
Well, those aspects of Terry's life were embarrassing. But I think the public is mature enough to draw a distinction between the mistakes and the weaknesses of our children and the strength of the candidate. So I doubt if that would have spilled over in a way that would have been seriously damaging to me. Terry was also a great asset to me politically. She went out and campaigned all over this country for me in 72, and she did the same thing in state races in South Dakota. I would put it to you this way, on balance, I would take Terry McGovern as an ally anytime, despite the difficulties that she had.
Do you think you'd be more likely in today's political arena to have an opponent who would try to use your daughter's problems against you?
It's possible, but they might have gotten a boomerang on it even today. I think voters would have resented trying to use the difficulties of a teenager, the difficulties of a younger woman like Terry against their father. I don't think that would work today. It wouldn't have worked in the 1960s.
George McGovern, I really want to thank you for talking with us, and I'm really sorry about your loss.
Thank you so much for having me on.
George McGovern's new book is called Terry, My Daughter's Life and Death Struggle with Alcoholism. Coming up, a review of Ani DeFranco's new CD. This is Fresh Air. At the age of 25, Ani DeFranco has already released 8 albums, all on her own label, Righteous Babe Records. This singer-songwriter, based in Buffalo, New York, has developed a fervent cult following for her high-powered folk rock, and her new release, called Dilate, is already bringing her more visibility. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Sleepwalking through the all-night drugstore, baptized in fluorescent light. Found religion in the greeting card aisle, and now I know Hallmark was right. And every pop song on the radio is suddenly speaking to me. Yeah, art may imitate life, but life imitates TV.
For anyone new to the sound of Ani DeFranco, it's tempting to hear her yelping intensity and breathless confessional lyrics as a timely ripoff of the multi-million-selling Alanis Morissette. But DeFranco was peddling articulate female rage long before Morissette. She sold over 250,000 copies of her albums. That's peanuts compared to Morissette's millions, but DeFranco has done it virtually all on her own. She started Righteous Babe Records in her Buffalo basement, and it's turned into such a profitable independent label that DeFranco, a bristling capitalist with feminist integrity, has felt free enough to turn down offers from major record companies. She's even written a self-congratulatory song about her situation called Napoleon.
They told you your music could reach millions, but the choice was up to you. Told me they always pay for lunch. They believe in what I do. And I wonder, will you miss your old friends once you've proven what you're worth? Yeah, I wonder when you're a big star.
DeFranco's is such an admirable success story, it makes me wish all the more that her music was better. For the most part, she's all attitude without much content, strumming her acoustic guitar with great vehemence and delivering her cliches with immense sincerity. But DeFranco's observations are trite, to say the least. In the song that opened this review, Superhero, she tells us, "Life imitates TV," as if she just stumbled upon a conspiracy theory worthy of the X-Files. And on the title song of this collection, she informs her listeners that, quote, "Life used to be lifelike, now it's more like showbiz." You get the feeling old Ani just got around to looking at a few episodes of the old Jack Benny show and they blew her mind.
Life used to be lifelike, now it's more like showbiz. I wake up in the night and I don't know where the bathroom is. I don't know what town I'm in. What sky I'm under, and I wake up in the darkness. I don't have the will anymore to wonder. And everyone has a skeleton, a closet to keep it in. Every song has a you that the singer sings to. And you're at this time, baby, you're at this time. And when I need to wipe my face, I use the back of my hand. And I like to take up space just because I can. And I use my dress to wipe up my drink. You know I care less and less what people think. And you are so lame, you know. You always disappoint me. It's kind of like a running joke. It's really not funny. And I just want you to live up to the image of you I create. I see you and I'm so unsatisfied. I see you and I die alone.
Ani DeFranco is the sort of self-righteous babe whose essentially acoustic earnestness convinces sympathetic listeners that she's imparting both truth and intimacy. But I like both of these qualities decked out with either a lot more artfulness or a lot less. Sure, I'm glad DeFranco is a defiant, independent little cuss. The New York Times recently compared her marathon shows with those of Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan. But as I dilate upon dilate, all I hear is the new Billy Joel.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Dilate, the new release from Ani DeFranco. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Phoebe Vanskoy is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
The wind is ruthless, the trees shake, angry fingers at the sky. People hunch their shoulders, hold their collars over their ears and run by. It's a cold rain, it's a hard rain, like the kind that you find in songs. I guess that makes me the jerk with the heartache, here to sing to you about how I...
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux, publisher of Messages from My Father, a new memoir by Calvin Trillin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.